Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Alana Levine.
You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Hey, I heard you need an inspiration. He's a lot of end friends with some revelations. Little known back to the day. Every little thing's gonna be a-okay.
Little known fact about my guest today, she has either won or been nominated for every major acting award that there is. I am so honored to have the legend Barbara Barry on the podcast.
A-OK. A-OK.
Hey, everyone. My guest today is the award-winning actress Barbara Barry. Ms. Barry has had a distinguished career in film, television, and theater. On Broadway, she appeared in the original production of Company, for which she was Tony Award nominated. She was also in The Selling of the President, The Prisoner of Second Avenue, California Suite, Torch Song Trilogy, and Significant Other most recently. She became a household name when she starred in the TV series Barney Miller. Some of her other TV appearances include Law and Order, Breaking Away, Suddenly Susan, Enlightened, Nurse Jackie, 30-something, and Family Ties. Some of her miniseries and TV movie credits include Roots, The Next Generation, The Odd Couple, Together Again, To Race the Wind, American Love Affair, and Barefoot in the Park. Some of her film credits include One Potato, Two Potato, for which she won Best Actress Award at the Cannes Film Festival, Breaking Away, for which she was nominated for an Academy Award, Judy Berlin, for which she was an Independent Spirit Award nominee, Frame of Mind, Second Best, Hercules, Private Benjamin, The Bell Jar, 30 Days. I could go on and on, but I'd rather speak to Ms. Harnick myself. Barbara Barry, your married name is Harnick, correct?
Yes.
But in life, did you go through life as Barbara Barry for work, Barbara Harnick for non-work, or always Barbara Barry?
No, I was always Barbara Barry because when I to get my equity card, there was another Barbara Berman. And you can't have two people in the union with the same name. So I had to choose a name in a minute because I had a job coming up to get my equity card. So I just took Barry because of the playwright. I just said, well, I'll do that. And that's always been my, you know, my professional name.
So you grew up Barbara Berman.
Yes.
And you grew up where?
Corpus Christi, Texas.
So is Berman a Jewish name?
Yes.
And were there many other Jewish families in Corpus Christi at the time?
Yes, because it was wartime when we moved there. I was seven when we moved, and there were many Jews who were coming down to make their fortunes. It was a naval base.
I see.
There was a Reform congregation. There was an Orthodox congregation, and there was an in-between. So there are a lot of Jews. There are not a lot of Jews in my age group. So all my friends were almost all non-Jews. But there were my mother and father had many friends and many activities. It was a very active community.
So when you say you moved there when you were a young girl, where did you move there from?
Chicago.
So why did your parents move from Chicago to Corpus Christi at the time?
Well, My father, when he was in college, was in the ROTC, and he had what they used to call a bivouac. That's more, you don't understand that, but they would take the whole ROTC down to a place, and they took them to Corpus Christi because it was already in a naval situation. And my father remembered it very, he loved it. It was so beautiful. And when the Depression came, he had to change his life. So he packed us all up in a car like the Jodes. And we moved to Texas with all our possessions on the car roof with no money, and started a new life there. My brother was 14 and I was 7. And my mother and father were, you know, they'd been married for some years, but they had a very rich life in Chicago. And all of a sudden we were, you know, poverty stricken in Texas. It was a depression.
And do you have a memory of that road trip?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. First of all, my father, when he was in college, never forgot this. And he kept saying, look at the sky. Look at the cows. Look at the... There are no clouds like Texas clouds. And we would stop and get out of the car and look at it. And he was just in love with Texas. And I remember it very well. I remember it very, and I remember my mother crying because she was so miserable. And then we got there and we lived in a little shack on the beach because it was all my father could afford. And I did go to school and I did make friends immediately, which was great. And we just struggled, and finally, you know, he made a living. He was a college graduate with an English degree, and they put him to work at the radio station as an announcer because he was, you know, he had this great Bostonian voice, and he struggled back. It was, everybody was in the same boat, you know, there was no money anywhere.
Is that what he ended up doing? Was radio basically his life as you were growing up?
Well, after he graduated, he should have been a professor, absolutely. But in those days, Jewish men didn't become professors, they became businessmen. Mm-hmm. So he got a job with an insurance company, the Equitable Life Insurance Company. When he went to Texas, he kept doing that, and he was a wonderful insurance man. But then the war came, and they needed people who were educated and who could speak on the radio and who knew what was going on. And they came after him, and he loved it. He went to work as an announcer and a news commentator, and he just loved it.
But how crazy to go from selling insurance to somehow someone finding you, getting you on the radio. It's such a strange crossover. It's not the most organic linear ride, but that's what ended up happening.
You're a very good questioner because it is odd. It is odd. But he was so clearly, I'm sorry to say this, but he was so clearly above the crowd. You know, he knew music, he knew literature, he knew world affairs, he was a Harvard educated man. He knew stuff.
Right.
And they grabbed him because they needed people, because all the other people were going off to war.
Right. Did your mom eventually find a place for herself as well in Corpus Christi?
Yeah, she did. She became part of the Jewish, you know, women's community, and she was very social, and she did. She ended up liking it quite a lot, actually. But she did adjust. Yes, she adjusted. And she made lots of friends. She was very social.
So how did theater become a part of your life?
Well, you know, I don't know. I was drafted to do a show for the Corpus Christi Little Theater. It was an old English show called Gammer Gurton's Needle. And they needed a girl who looked like me or who, you know, I don't know. They came to my mother and said, does she want to do this? And I said, okay, I had no ambition to be an actress, and I did it. And I guess I was okay. And then things just built as I got older, and I did stuff in high school, and then I really did stuff in junior college. I had a great teacher, and that kind of spurred me on to doing theater all over Texas. You know, we would go as a team, but I never intended to make it a career, ever, because it was unrealistic in those days. You know, you got married, or you became a teacher, or I didn't know what I wanted. I thought I would be a teacher, so I went to Texas University to major in drama education. And that's what I did for the first year.
And what brought you to New York, where you really started off kind of right away getting stuff to do? So how did you get from Texas to New York?
Well, I graduated, for one thing.
Right.
I graduated Texas University, and I had an incredibly good liberal arts education. I mean, that was a great school. And my boyfriend from college, and he was right away in a Broadway play, right away. And I followed him. And I said, well, I guess I'll stay. And I started working in offices and stuff. I really did not pursue a career. But I worked in a theatrical office, and somebody found me, and somebody thought I should do it. You know, it's one of those things that just kind of happened. I really came to be with him. And we worked together for a long time. And then he got married, and I started to work. It's just one of those things. I didn't have a burning ambition.
Mm. But you had talent and luck. Those two things came and found you.
And when I got here, I realized I wasn't prepared for a professional career. Because as good as the university was, they did not teach a really organic way of working. So I studied with Uta Hagen, and I auditioned for her. And so did my boyfriend, and we both got in. And I stayed with her for over 4 years while I was working. I was working the whole time.
Right.
And she kept saying, you're too slick. You're too professional. You're too slick. You gotta start from the beginning. But she said that to everybody in the class.
Uh-huh.
And none of you really knows how to act. And in the class were me, my boyfriend, Ann Mira, Jerry Stiller, Charles Nelson Reilly, Shelley Berman, a lot of other people. And she said to us all, you don't know how to act. That was the first day. And she was white.
Mm-hmm.
I was making a living, but I wasn't really, as my husband used to say, sending my message to the world. I didn't know how to do that. I just knew how to be very professional. And I worked a lot. I also worked on my off times. I worked in factories, by the way, and I worked in offices, and I worked in restaurants.
So many day jobs.
Yeah,
and night jobs.
Many day jobs.
Yeah, yeah.
But I kept going forward. And also, I got a very good agent through one of my professors in Austin, and she really pushed me. And I ended up at the American Shakespeare Festival in Westport, Connecticut, where I spent two glorious years doing Shakespeare with a lot of great people. And because I had been trained in that, we were trained to do Shakespeare. We were trained to do the classics,
right,
in Austin.
Right.
So it was luck. A lot of it was luck.
Incredible. I mean, I was looking at your credits, and your first film credit, although it says uncredited, was in Giant.
Yes, I had five lines or something.
Who was in the scene?
I don't remember. I think it was Elizabeth Taylor. and I think it was Rock Hudson. I do remember it was a funeral scene. And I said, the character says something stupid. And the director, George, what was his name? The famous director.
Anyway,
who?
Was it George Cukor?
No. It was, I'll think of it. Anyway,
okay.
He said to me, the minute you say it, you wish you could put it back in your mouth.
Right.
Such a good direction.
Yes.
And I did it, and we were there. I was on that show for weeks because Rock Hudson had another engagement he had to finish, and James Dean refused to come to work. And so we used to sit around waiting for James Dean.
Uh-huh.
And I made a lot of money. It was my first job. I was just out of college. Just.
Wow. Yeah. George Stevens, right?
George Stevens.
Yes.
Good girl. Right. Exactly good. And he was great. Because, you know, the reason I got the job was they needed somebody with a Texas accent. And I was there with a boyfriend, new boyfriend, who was a very established actor. And he knew George Stevens. And he said to George Stevens, my girlfriend's from Texas. And I went to meet him. I didn't even have to audition. I just talked to him. And he said, okay, the job is yours. So that was fun.
That's incredible. And you learned about how much of making a movie is sitting around and waiting to make a movie. That's of what it is. I have to fast forward, although we're going to skip around, because we seem to be in a moment where there is this, not that it ever went away, but there has just been this passion and complete obsession with Stephen Sondheim and his productions. The revival of Company, Merrily We Roll Along is on Broadway. Here We Are. There's just a passion happened a few years ago, again, a revival. There's a show going on in London right now of his. And you are in what is one of the most iconic musical theater productions written by Stephen Sondheim called Company. And you were nominated for a Tony. And so many people know about it because of the video of the filming of your making the cast recording, the original Broadway cast recording. It's very famous. And the Elaine Stritch moment of it all. I wonder, all these years later, what you can share. How did you get into that production? Was it a joyous experience, a hard experience, making something from scratch with a really beautiful company like that? What comes to mind when I bring up that production?
Well, first of all, none of us knew what we were doing. And the reason I got into it was because they were trying to cast this part. And so we were all friends, and somebody said, we need somebody like Barbara Harnick. And so Stephen said, or somebody said, why don't we get Barbara Harnick?
I said, Did you know him before this?
We all knew each other.
So you ran with the same crowd. You were all friends.
My husband was a musician and a producer.
Right.
And a performer, and he knew everybody. We were all very friendly. And somebody said, oh, yeah, why don't we get her? Let's call her. And so they sent me the script, actually. Hal Prince sent me the script. And he said, pick the part you want to do. And I love the woman who did karate because I'm so physical. And I said, oh, I'd like to do that. And he said, okay, all Steve wants to do is hear you sing a song. You don't have to audition. And I got coached up the kazoo.
Mm-hmm.
A very famous coach named David Craig. And I went in to do the audition with a friend with whom I'd worked up the scene. And I did the song. And Steve and Hal came down to the stage and they said, okay, the part is yours. It's fine. And I said, but I have a scene to work. I have a scene. We don't have to see the scene, Barbara. The part is yours. And I said, no, you got to see the scene. So my friend Terry Kaiser and I did the scene, which ultimately was the karate scene. And they said, oh, that's really good. And I said, now I'm going to go take karate, Steve. and you're going to pay for it. He said, what? No, I said to Hal, Hal, who's notoriously tight. I said, I found this teacher on Broadway. He's crazy, but he knows karate, and I'm going to study with him for about 6 or 8 weeks. He said, no, I'm not paying for that. I said, yes, you are. I'm going to do that. And I did it, and he paid for it.
That's
and
incredible.
I brought all that work into rehearsal. And we, out of that work, Michael Bennett choreographed that scene. So, you know, it was like it was handed to me. But if I did it over again, I wouldn't choose that part, because that part is the only part that did not have a song.
Uh-huh.
And I was so frustrated the whole time because I couldn't.
Right.
I sang in the group, but I didn't have a song. Anyway.
Right. And
in answer to your question, at one time, we were still in the rehearsal hall, and I said to Hal, what is this musical about? And he said, I don't have a clue. He had no idea.
Uh-huh.
We all just kept working on these couples, and it turned out it was probably about marriage.
Mm-hmm.
But that they didn't start out thinking that. So we fumfered around a lot. You know, we were struggling in Boston to try to find the right length of dances and who did what. And it was a struggle. It wasn't, it was not joyous at all, because Steve was Hal was a very hard taskmaster. And Stephen was greatly supportive, but he only wanted to hear it if it was perfect. So mm-hmm. You couldn't sing anything for him until we had learned it. And the opening number was, my husband said, it was the hardest opening number he's ever seen. And he was a sight singer and a performer, but he taught it to me. Jay taught me the number. And it was hard. And you know, we were all young marrieds, middle marrieds with little kids. And we had little kids to put to bed and to feed and to... It was a very strenuous time for all of us. Not that we didn't love it. It was a great thing. But I don't even think at the time we understood how groundbreaking it was. Because if you know that, we did not get universal reviews. So it took a while for that show to find its own feet. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But it was a wonderful experience.
How long did it have a good run on Broadway?
Well, it did, but not as good as it should have had. It mm-hmm. was not a big hit. Mm-hmm. It ran about, I guess, nine months.
You were nominated for a Tony.
Yeah, I was. But we never sold out. And it was very controversial because people said, what is this musical about? I mean, they're talking about marriage and they're talking about, you know, relationships. And what is this about?
Right. It was a new language. I mean, it was a new kind of conversation. Once you were, I mean, I know that you have done so many things, but once you were up and running, were you as a company, did you have some laughs once it was happening? And were you a close company or were you
Yes. No, we all got along very well. I mean, there are always little, you know, flare-ups and stuff. But we got along very well. We were united in trying to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
And because the scenes were separate, each couple had a different scene, there was a sense of competition. At the end of the night, we would go up in an elevator, and I won't tell you who, but somebody used to say, well, I was very good tonight. You know, and we would say, good. And then the next night she would say, I was really good tonight. So there was a sense of competition. But, you know, it was not an easy show to do. And they kept futzing with it. And we were asked to do some stuff that we said as a group, we're not going to do that.
Mm. Meaning within the show?
Wanted us to be off stage and make noises about making love. About, oh, this is so great, and touch me there. We were all married people with little children. And we said to them, we're not going to do this. Uh-huh. This isn't what you do, even when you're making love. And they said, well, what would you do? We made it up. We said, oh, my God, I forgot to put a cover on the baby. Oh, my God, is the radiator still on in that room? Right. Oh, I got to take her water. She's coughing. That's what people do.
Yeah.
And so they got very angry with us. But we stuck together as a group, and we said, we're not going to do it. And so we didn't do it.
Right.
It was tawdry, you know, it was cheap.
Right. And you felt like it was beneath you.
Well, it wasn't that. It was what during the scene where Donna McKechnie dances and the stewardess and Bobby are in bed. And they wanted us to voice over that it wasn't beneath us. It was unrealistic.
I see. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
It was unrealistic and it was cheap to be sexy offstage. Who needs that?
Yeah.
It wasn't. And so we didn't often do that. But as a group, we said, no, no, we're not doing this. So
you had veto power.
Yes.
What about Ladies Who Lunch? Was there an awareness at the time that this would become a song, an iconic part of musical theater history? Was there an awareness when you were doing the show what that would become?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she was so incredible. And the song was so incredible. There was no question it was epic making. And, you know, Elaine was a big star and a big diva. And she got her way. And, I mean, I just adored her. She was difficult, but I adored her. She also adored my children, by the way. Mm-hmm. Was so
That's
sweet.
Nice. Yeah.
But anyway, yes, it was clear. That was almost like the highlight of the show.
Mm-hmm. So in that documentary of the making of the original Broadway cast recording, there's a lot of pressure on her. You describe Stephen as someone who was quite exact, right? He really wanted it to be perfect, and the pressure of recording an album. And you see during that recording that she is really suffering in the recording studio to get it the way it should be. Did she feel that way nightly in the show, or it was really just doing it on the day in the recording studio that was so rough?
No, I don't want to go into it, but in the recording studio, she was less than, what can I say, with it.
Mm-hmm.
She was having some problems.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what made it so difficult for her.
Mm-hmm.
I was having problems. Because they only paid us $147 for 22 hours of work. And I had already been doing a lot of television. And I said to the company, we should be getting a week's salary for this.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't pay it. So I called the union. They came down. It was very unpleasant. They never paid us except for $147 before agents and before taxes. And Penny Baker took that film and played it all over the world. And that's the reason I have the dark glasses on, because they wanted to interview me. And I said, I'm not being interviewed. You're not paying us. And to this day, Hal Prince held it against me. I mean, he's dead now, but until the day he died, he held it against me. He was angry with me.
That you wanted to be compensated fairly.
Paid. They exploited the entire cast. So that's
so to this day, between the movie and the actual recording, all you made was the original $147 for the 22 hours of recording.
That's right.
Barbara, that is unbelievable.
Well, it's what happened.
That is unbelievable. Thank God you went on to make very big movies, for which you were nominated. So I watched the moment when you are in the audience, when you are nominated for Breaking Away, and I see that you have both your children with you in the audience at the Oscars. Was that a thrilling night, a harrowing night? Do you think about that night other than when you're asked about it? What's the takeaway?
Well, I think about Aaron because he was so upset he wanted me to win so badly. And I kept saying, if you see, look at it, I'm bending down to talk to him. And I say, Aaron, I'm not going to win this. Don't be upset. And he was desolate. And that's what I remember. And then at the banquet, he was so upset, he fell over into his plate. And my husband had to take him back to the hotel.
Oh my God.
It was not an easy night, believe me.
So it was really Aaron's night. At the end of the day, it was his to win and his to lose.
Right. On the way down, you know, they send you a limo and they had candy and they had drinks and they all this stuff for the kids. So it was very festive. I knew I wasn't going to win. Meryl Streep was in my category and she was not a supporting player. She was a leading player. What they put her in, I knew I wasn't going to win. Yeah. And I kept telling both children, don't be disappointed. It's an honor to be, you know, nominated. And but Aaron just, he really had a nervous breakdown. So anyway, that it was difficult. It was difficult.
It must have been thrilling, though. I mean, when I think about you having sort of fallen into it, right? Like, it wasn't like from the time you were young, you had your eyes set on stardom and the glitter that comes with it. I think the idea that you have been nominated or won every category of accolade for an actress, it's an extraordinarily beautiful thing. And I think about when you say, yeah, like we were all friends, although it sounds like the record was an issue between you and Hal after that show. But well, that's, I mean, who you ran around with.
Yeah, but the actor, we were all, the actress were all friends.
Yeah, yeah.
We went through hell in Boston. They kept changing it, and Elaine hated her costumes. We all hated our costumes, and we had to get rid of the person who did it and get somebody else. It's a typical, you know, they say hell is being out of town with a musical. Well, that's exactly what it was. And I had two children in my hotel room.
Can we talk about that? The idea, you know, your husband was, as you said, a musician and a performer and a singer and a producer. He started Theater Works. I mean, this incredible, incredible institution focused on bringing really good theater to young people. I think there was a quote, you know, not just singing vegetables, but really to expose young people to the power and beauty of theater. You have, I assume you were based in New York. Did you raise your kids in New York?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I went out every, you know, almost every summer to do a series. I did Barney Miller. I did 9 series altogether. And everybody went with me.
I see. So that's what happened.
Jay went, but Jay couldn't stay. He had to go back and forth because he was running Theater Works. But we got great houses with swimming pools and tennis courts. And we had a great, and in September, the children always said, we want to go home. Mm-hmm. They wanted to come back to New York because they hated being schlepped around in a car all the time.
Right.
And they missed their school. And so we always came home. But they grew up here. Jane, they were born in Manhattan, both of them. And they're, you know, they're East Coast kids.
So who is your support system? I mean, your IMDb page is, you know, longer than any of our CVS receipts at this point. That's the best way I can describe it, guys. Or a hospital bill, if you see one. I mean, Barbara, your extensive career in every lane of possible in acting. So as you're going to be Goldie Hawn's mom in Private Benjamin or doing The Odd Couple or Barney Miller, which was many, many episodes, and suddenly Susan for seasons, who is like home, sort of, who could you depend on to know, okay, it's really stressful being away from your kids, but that's part of your job. Who was in the apartment or your home with them when you were away?
Well, first of all, Jay was a great father, great father. And secondly, we had a series of absolutely remarkable women who not only lived with us or didn't live with us, but went to California with us. We had a woman named Ann Adams, who was my housekeeper when I was single, and she cared for the kids until they were 10 or 11. Then we had another woman named Josephine Small, who was divine. And then we had a couple. One I had to fire, was so horrible. But most of the time, I had excellent help. And even when we went to Pittsburgh with Bill Ball, when Jane was just born, I found a couple there who helped me run this dreadful tenement house that we were given to live in. I always lucked out, with one or two exceptions. I had somebody walked into the house who was really ghastly. But Jay was always there, and he was so great.
You know, for people listening, one of the other reasons Harnick, not just because of Barbara and her husband, but Sheldon Harnick was your brother-in-law. Mm-hmm. And Sheldon wrote Fiddler on the Roof. Mm-hmm. So Jay's family also super, super theatrical.
Yes, they are. Their mother was a singer. They had an aunt who was a singer. We have a nephew, one of Jay's nephews, who was the first flute at the Metropolitan Opera for 35 years.
Incredible DNA.
Producer of opera.
Wow.
His name is Michael Parlow. Everybody's musical. And Erin's little girl, who's 10, has inherited all of it. She's now decided to be an actress, but she's willing to train, and she's taking lessons. And she has a voice that is so incredible. The Harnick pipes, they all sing, you know. Well, Jane doesn't sing, but everybody else sings. And it's in the DNA. It's in their
genes. It's incredible.
And the thing is that when I did the last show on Broadway, you know,
Significant
Other.
Yeah.
Wanted me to do my bio. You have to give a bio, and they look at it and they edit it. And I said to Erin, my son, I said, this is so boring. It's so long. And he looked at it and he said, Mom, nobody is interested in what you did 20 years ago. Nobody. It's too long. It's too boring. And he said, I'm going to write you your bio for this play. So this is what he wrote. He said, Barbara Barry has been nominated for an Oscar, 3 Emmys, and a Tony. And she didn't win any of them. But she has 3 miraculous granddaughters, Roxy, Mabel, and Lulu. That's what he wrote. And that the director, Trip Coleman, said to me, and I walked in, when he said, that's the best bio I ever read in my entire life. I said, yes, my son wrote it. Because, you know, none of that matters as long as your kids are okay. And it turns out, as of just 2 weeks ago, that Lulu, who is an expert gymnast and she's 10, she said to her dad, I want to go on the stage. And she's ready to study. She is studying.
I want to, you know, get back to, because the thing you just mentioned sort of at the center of what's important to you is craft, right?
Right.
Like that this young girl is already understanding, like, you can have all this natural talent, but there's a craft, whatever she ends up doing, right?
Oh, she wants to study, yeah.
Right. So when you go back, because you are, you know, if anyone Googles you, they can also find a lot of video of you and Uta Hagen and Fritz Weaver, like, talking about the work and the process and what it is. I wonder if you could just share a little with listeners, when you think back to kind of the work and things Uta taught you and that you've learned along the way, decades and decades and decades of working and putting craft to great use, what are things that you feel like, you know what, I am this age, I am still, every time I go into work or I get a script, I think about this, right? To send my message out, as you articulated so beautifully earlier on, and in Jay's words, but that's Jay, what you've been doing.
Yeah.
What? How do you begin?
Well, I am as clear as a bell about it. And you're very smart to ask that question, because I have realized in the past few, really almost in the past few months, because I've been doing some interviews and stuff, that what you finally come down to as an artist is you want to tell stories. You're telling stories. And the stories you tell, you hope, have a message that influences other people in whatever small way. Do you know what I mean? You were a storyteller. I'm a storyteller. I'm not a star. I'm not a person who ever wanted to be a star. And Uta used to say, I used to say to her, when do you stop being nervous about performing? And she said, you stop being nervous when it's only the work that matters. That's a very big lesson. The work is, that's all that matters. It doesn't matter whether you know, whatever. But she used to give a very good tip about acting. And she used to say, before you step on the stage, think to yourself as the character, what is the last thing I do before I step on the stage in that scene? Which keeps you from just entering. Do you know what I mean? You have a life before you enter the scene. And when you, and then I had another director who said, while you're playing a scene, you're going to go somewhere else afterwards. Remember that, so that you don't play it, just play a scene, like an actor who plays a scene. So it gave me a very good ladder of rules. And in the long run, now at my advanced age, I really, in answer to your question, it's the privilege of telling stories. And my work is like, I have gotten over, it has gotten so simple. All the junk has gone, you know, because in the long run, that's what you do. You reach out to an audience in some small way and you say, I hope you're getting this, but it doesn't matter. What matters to me is the work. And what matters to me is the message, as my husband used to say. It's your, Barbara, if it isn't your message to the world, don't do the part. He was always right. I picked a couple of things that were not successful. He said, don't do it. It's not your part. And does that answer your question?
Beautifully, beautifully. I really appreciate that. I mean, it's funny. It sounds so simple, but where are you coming from and where are you going, right? These are really, and it's harder than you think. It's harder than you think.
It is harder, but think about your own life. If you're cooking in the kitchen, you know that in a few minutes you're going to go and empty the garbage, or somebody's going to come in the door who's coming for dinner. There's mm-hmm. always an after moment, and there's yeah. a bit of a moment. And when you think about whatever you're doing right before you enter the stage, whether it's drinking a glass of water, scratching your nose, or talking to your children, it gives you a real person who's entering the stage, not just an actor who's coming on to play a scene.
Right, right.
I've learned from great teachers, you know. Uta was she was an incredible teacher, and she was a great mentor of mine. She pushed me in various places.
Right.
And I could never get over that she was on my side. Do you know what I mean?
Because she was such a formidable person, or was she rougher on some people than others? Or what do you mean by that?
She was rough on all of us.
Right.
You know, she used to say, she said to me, I did a scene from Chekhov once that she assigned, by the way.
Yeah.
And I said, I can't do Chekhov. I was very young. I said, I don't know how to do it. She said, I want you to do this scene. Do it. So, you know, you rehearse for a week or two with another actor, and then you go to class. We were in this shabby room on 6th Avenue. It was long before this, you know, the studio. And I did the scene, and she said to me, you're right. You can't do it. You don't know how to do it. I told you, I don't know how to do it. She said, don't do it anymore. And I didn't until very recently.
You took on Chekhov.
Yeah, but I mean, not for years.
Yeah.
Now I know how to do it. I can mm-hmm. do it with my eyes closed. But she was so smart. She said, no, you're right. You can't do it. Mm-hmm. So I had wonderful mentors along the way, you know. I had great teachers at the university, too.
Yeah, it sounds like it. What an incredible start.
Yeah, the acting classes, they were as I told you, geared toward the classics.
Right.
But don't forget, I got a degree. I mean, we took dramatic criticism, theater history. We learned how to make costumes. You had to take an advanced art history course. I mean, I was educated in the liberal arts. And when I read this stuff going on now, people saying it's not really important, liberal arts anymore. It is very important. It's the basis of all humanity. It's how you think.
Yeah.
And I really had a wonderful experience.
You had to go back to your parents and sort of, you know, your father you described as like a really cultured individual. Did they get to see you do Broadway, be on stage, come to things you did in screenings? No.
My mother came to the American Shakespeare Festival in Westport. I was there 2 years, and she came every summer.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe she saw Company. I don't know. But my father, no, because my father died when I was 15.
Oh.
And he didn't get to see me do anything.
Wow.
It was him, through him, that I love. I'm insane about classical music because he was.
Hmm.
And after dinner, a lot of the times, he used to make my brother and me sit down and read a Shakespeare scene. He was imbued with the English language and music.
Wow.
And he spoke Yiddish, and he spoke French, and he spoke Latin. I mean, he was incredible. And I didn't really appreciate it. You don't appreciate your parents when you're that young.
Right. Well, nor did you ever think, that's very young to lose a parent. That's not how the story is supposed to go. So we don't know. We never know about time in that way. What a legacy. What a legacy. You've done the Burmans proud, for sure.
Yes.
You have a beautiful family, and I can really tell that somehow you were able to hold space for career and family and make it work, which is really hard for anyone in any career, but especially.
And I made some mistakes along the way, but hello.
Before I let you go, before I let you go, this is the Little Known Facts podcast. Is there a little known fact about Barbara Berman Barry Harnick that you can share with my listeners?
About my life or about
anything, any little known fact about you?
Well, it's not all that interesting, I don't think, but two things I can tell you. When I met my husband at a backers audition in New York, right on Central Park West, we had both gone to hear it. They were raising money. You know what a backers audition is.
Sure.
And I had just graduated college, and he was there, but he wasn't performing. And I took one look at him and fell hopelessly in love. Hopelessly. One look. Are you there?
I am.
And to make a long story short, we never dated. We were friends. But 12 years later, we got married.
Beautiful.
And it was the motivating force of my life, because I had never felt like that before. I mean, I felt my knees buckle.
Wow.
And so that was that. And the other thing I was going to tell you. The highlight of my acting life was I did Twelfth Night in the Park. And I played Viola, which is the greatest part in Shakespeare for a young woman ever written. And I played Viola in the park. Joe Papp directed it. And I found during that run, how you find your inner life and how you get your message across to the audience with barely doing anything. Do you know what I mean? It was a huge discovery. Mm. And that was the highlight of my acting life.
Wow. That's incredible. Well, this is a highlight of my podcasting life. Barbara, thank you so much for being on the show with us today. I am so honored and thrilled. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
You too. Thank you.
Feel well.
Thank you, love.
Clouds can make the wind blow. Bugs can make the grass grow. So there you go.
I have some news. Little Known Facts is now available to watch on YouTube. Hours and hours and hours of interviews that you can see my fabulous guests. And guess what? It's called Little Known Facts with Alana Levine. Catchy, right? Anyway, head on over to YouTube and watch the podcast. And please don't forget to subscribe. Also, if you want to donate to the podcast, zero pressure. But if you want to, no donation is too big or too small. I am so grateful for you for listening. But if you want to donate, just go to littleknownfactspodcast.com/donations. Lastly, Little Known Facts is recorded in Brooklyn, New York, USA. My editor is Nicholas Klar. None of this happens without Nicholas. And the Little Known Facts theme song was composed and sung by Georgia Famusa with backup vocals by Caleb Famusa. Thank you for listening and have an amazing day.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.